let's get talking about what I call the ring of truth, or how the Gospels authenticate one another. I always like to start talks like this with a verse of Scripture, and I couldn't think of anything better to use here than Luke chapter 1, verse 4, where Luke is writing in the preface to his Gospel, "It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty regarding the things you have been taught." I hope by the time that we're done today, you understand why I chose that as an epigraph for this talk, and that I have increased your confidence in some of the things that you have been taught. Our goals here are to explore some of the positive internal evidence for the truth of the Gospels. There are a couple of different ways to carve up the apologetics map. I like to think of this in terms of defensive and positive. Defensive is answering all the objections people can lay out, and there are a lot, right? Even the Gospels cover a lot of territory. There are a lot of things people can quibble at. Giving answers to those is part of the apologetics project. Giving a positive case is a different matter. You could answer all the objections. They could still say, yeah, but that doesn't prove it's right. And they would be right. So giving a positive case, that's what we're looking at here. And then the positive case can be made in two ways. You can look at evidence within the Gospels themselves, or you can look at the Gospels and look outside to Jewish history, secular history, and see how that makes contact with what we read in the Gospels. Today, I'm going to be talking about the internal evidence. Tomorrow, come back, same time, different room, don't ask. There, we're going to do some of the external evidence. So this is internal positive evidence, and it's part of a cumulative case where we put example upon example, fact upon fact, and we build this up in layers. A cumulative case that the authors of the Gospels were well-informed and habitually truthful. Those are the goals that I've set for this talk today. I've got two questions I want you to think about at the outset. First question is, why are there four Gospels? Have you ever wondered why they couldn't just have sat down and had a little committee discussion and written one Gospel, beginning to end, no odd, loose ends, no discrepancies, nothing to try to tie together? Why don't we just have one account of the life of Jesus? Some of the early church fathers wrote harmonies of the Gospels. Tatian, the pupil of Justin Martyr in the middle of the second century, wrote a single flowing harmony of the four Gospels. Why couldn't it have been like that to start? Would have saved us a bunch of trouble. Second question is, can we tell by comparing two passages of Scripture with one another, just internally? It's all in your own Bible. Can we tell by comparing them that both of them are authentic, credible, historical records? Now, you might think, well, yeah, sure, we can do that because we can find passages where two different writers tell the same story, maybe in almost the same words. Okay, but let your inner skeptic free for a minute. What's the obvious skeptical response to that? They copied from one another. One guy got it from the other. It's collusion. It's the same feeling we have if we see somebody stand up in court and give testimony, and it's like sounding, okay, you know, maybe that's true. And then the next witness comes along and says exactly the same words in exactly the same order. You start to say, wait a minute, that sounds weird. So it might be very difficult to try to argue that this is an independent witness. Maybe he's just using material from the other guy. So there's our obvious skeptical response. And so we have a question then. How can this possibility be ruled out just by comparing stuff internally? How would that even work? And the answer is something that goes by an old-fashioned name. Called undesigned coincidences. Isn't that a mouthful? I keep having friends on Facebook who try to type this out, and it always gets auto-corrected to undersigned coincidences. Wrong word. Stop. Undesigned coincidences are harder to describe than they are just to see when you do examples. But for a general description, one book might mention in passing some detail that answers questions raised by the other. That kind of interlocking isn't what you get in sheer copying. We know because we have examples of historians who have just copied from the written works of other historians. Usually what that means is they're writing a shorter version of it. We have something that is not to be expected if both were copied from a single written source. We have something not expected if the later source just added a bunch of legends to the former. This is not the way that fictions and forgeries look. They don't interlock like this. Nobody picks up the Fellowship of the Ring to see if they can get those loose ends tied together that were left over when they finished Moby Dick. Why not? Why don't you do that? Because the stories are not anchored in independent historical reality. But when things are anchored in independent historical reality, and you have multiple accounts by different people with their own agendas and the things they noticed or failed to notice, the things they decided to write about and the things they decided to leave out, sometimes there are interlockings like this. Let me give you an example from secular history, so you won't think this is something that's just made up as an apologetics gimmick. We have a lot of different accounts of the Battle of Midway in World War II. Any World War II buffs here? Yay, I love you people. So we have a lot of accounts of these. We've got Japanese generals and we've got American soldiers. One of the Japanese writers talks about the Battle of Midway, and right in the middle of his narrative, he just says, "And at this point, I saw a guy in a boat." Think about that for a minute. In the middle of the Pacific Ocean, in a battle, one guy in a boat. What's that? He doesn't know, so he doesn't say anything more about it. He just goes on. So you're scratching your head like, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Read, keep reading, keep reading. Eventually, perhaps you'll find the account of the American pilot who says that in one of his bombing runs, his plane was so badly shot up that he had to bail out and he deployed his life raft. Oh, a guy in a boat, right? Now, when you see that kind of connection, that indicates truthfulness on the part of both of the sources. It's not two guys both saying, "I saw a guy in a boat." It's indirect. And when they fit together like that, it's more like two pieces of a jigsaw puzzle fitting together, interlocking. That's the kind of interlocking that we're looking for. We would expect to find these kinds of things in authentic records of the same real event told by different people who knew what they were talking about. Why do we have four Gospels? There's a thought. Maybe there's something like that there. Some of you are from my generation, and you take notes. So for those who take notes, I recommend that you just find some blank space and put the names of the four evangelists at the corners of a box. And we'll do something with this. And there's a reason that we're going to do this that I'll bring out later. So if you're going to do that, grab some paper now. Just lay those out. I used to be able to give a talk like this and tell people, now turn in your Bibles, and everybody whips out their phones now. I'm like, what is this? Y'all a bunch of kids. All right. So let me give you an example that may make this clearer. Let's start with Matthew chapter 14. Now, several of the Gospels tell us the story of the death of John the Baptist, Jesus' kinsman, who is murdered while he's in custody. Herod Antipas has taken him into custody. And then there's the whole thing with Herodias and Salome. And Salome dances and he says, "I'll give you whatever you want." She goes to her mom, what do I want? I don't know what I want. And her mom says, "You want the head of John the Baptist." And so he has him beheaded. Matthew 14 tells that story. I'm not interested right now in the story itself. I'm interested in the setup. The first two verses. At that time, Herod the Tetrarch, Herod Antipas, Tetrarch of Galilee, heard about the fame of Jesus. And he said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He's been raised from the dead. That's why these miraculous powers are at work in him. What is going on? I had John killed." And then we go into the story of how John was killed. You've probably heard a sermon on this at some point. You probably haven't heard a sermon on the three words I am most concerned with. To his servants. That little bit, that detail, is not in Mark. It's not in any of the other Gospels. And it raises a very natural question. Who's Matthew? According to church tradition, Matthew is a tax collector then he's become a traveling preacher. How should he know what Herod the Tetrarch of Galilee is saying to his servants, presumably in the privacy of his own palace? Now, maybe the answer is, we don't know. That would be okay, right? There's a lot of stuff in history where we just don't know. We are not entitled to demand that the sands of time preserve the documents that would answer all of the casual questions we can raise. So that would be okay. But wouldn't it be more satisfying if we had a plausible answer to the question, how should Matthew know what Herod is saying to his servants? Well, I'm so glad that you asked. If you turn over to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 8, you do not learn the story of the death of John the Baptist. That's not what it's about. Luke 8 opens with a list of women who supported the ministry of Jesus and his disciples. And in verse 3, we're told that one of those women was Joanna. And then parenthetically, we're told who she is. Joanna, the wife of Chuza, Herod's household manager. Oh. The household manager. So, Jesus' followers have family in the highest ranks of Herod's servants. Chuza is his steward. It's a highly responsible position, one of the best paid retainers of someone like that. Now, it's no longer a mystery how Matthew could have information. In fact, he probably has better information about the death of John the Baptist than the Jewish historian Josephus. They tell a lot of the same details. Josephus makes a guess as to Herod's motives. We're told something different and more detailed in the Gospels. This is also a good reason for taking that as better information than the first century Jewish historian that we also have who talks about some of the same people. By the way, if you're here at 1:30 tomorrow in some totally different room, I'll give a talk where we use Josephus quite a lot. We're going to bring together a bunch of these external details. So be there or miss it. It's R something, 227? Okay, 227 is the room. So for those of you who are already decided, yes, I'm going to be here. I love you people. I was joking with somebody beforehand that both of the people who came to my talk would be here because they thought this was where Gary Habermas was supposed to be talking. All right. So if you are taking notes and you decided to do the little diagram, this is the point at which you can draw an arrow from Luke to Matthew, because Luke is explaining something in Matthew, which reading around in Matthew alone does not explain for us. There's a reason I'm having you do this diagram. I'll come back to that reason in a few minutes. What I want to stress, though, is that the whole case doesn't hang on one example. The point of making a cumulative case is that you're taking multiple pieces of evidence and you're putting them together in a coherent way. If you're putting together a jigsaw puzzle and you've put together part of the picture, you have the puppy's nose and his eye, part of an ear, you are not going to listen to the clever philosopher who comes along and tells you that these pieces aren't even part of the same picture at all and somebody just made them up at random, right? No, I'm sorry, that's stupid. I'm not going to do that. When you see multiple undesigned coincidences crisscrossing the Gospels in all directions, when you see that every one of the Gospel authors has independent sources of information and explains things, then the picture begins to emerge. And at that point, even if there are some pieces of your puzzle that are missing, you know full well these are authentic pieces of the original puzzle. Even if not all of your questions can be answered, you realize you have a faithful representation here. That's the way this is. We're going to see a picture beginning to emerge. And as that picture emerges, you'll have, I believe, your faith strengthened. But to do that, we have to do some more examples. Let's skip over to the Gospel of John. Okay. We read about the miracle at Cana. There were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. Now, here's the funny thing. I wash my hands after dinner because I've been handling food, and I brush my teeth after dinner because I've been eating food. But the jars are already standing empty. What's going on? The feast is still going. So that's kind of weird. But if you move over to Matthew, you discover what the Pharisees led us into, which is that it's a tradition of the elders to wash their hands before eating. But here Jesus' disciples were already sitting down and eating, and they hadn't washed their hands up front. Okay, the water pots were there for purification at the beginning. And for everyone, not just for priests. Originally, start, you know, reading through the Old Testament, you'll find that there are purification rites, but they're for the priests. But in the first century, we have what you might call the Puritan era in Judaism. This is the era when people took ceremonial laws that were written up for the priests, and they felt kind of a priesthood of all believers. It applied to them. And so this is a widespread practice, and scholars of this period now assure us that ritual purification before a meal was one of the most widespread practices. A small thing, a little link between John and Matthew. So if you're putting in arrows, then draw one down from Matthew down to John. Two examples. Yeah, but maybe that's just like two or three pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that are sort of the same color and you feel like they might fit together, but maybe we're forcing it. Keep going. Let's look at example number three. This is transfiguration. Do you remember this from Luke chapter 9? Jesus' face is altered. His clothing becomes dazzling white. He's up there on the mountain with just the core disciples. Moses and Elijah appear in glory and speak with him of his departure. A cloud covers them. A voice comes out of the cloud saying, "This is my beloved son. Hear him." And then how does Luke wind up his account? See, this is the problem. We all know a bunch of things that we're cramming together because we've read this story so many different times that we're blending together the different gospels. Luke wraps this up by saying, "And they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they had seen." What? If I were suddenly to have my clothing turn dazzling white and Moses and Elijah were to appear on stage and talk with me, you would probably go out and tell somebody about it. They kept silent. What is that even? How does it even make any sense at all? You know, I'm really glad that we have four gospels because we have other accounts of the same events. So if you read the story of the Transfiguration in Mark chapter 9, Mark gives you just a little bit more information. He says that as they were coming down the mountain, he charged them to tell no one what they had seen until the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Oh, Jesus told them not to talk about this. Okay, notice what Mark does not say. He doesn't say whether they did what he told them. You may think that's a no-brainer, right? Jesus told you to shut up, you shut up. Actually, read through the Gospels, take a pencil out, and mark your phone up. No, I mean, take a pencil out, read through the Gospels, and check how many times Jesus says, "Don't tell anyone," and people go and tell everyone. In all the Gospels, it's the only command I can think of that Jesus gives that is repeatedly violated. People are, "Don't tell anybody." He runs into town and tells everybody he's been healed. "Don't tell anybody," Jesus says. So what we have here is that Mark gives us the command, but he doesn't bother to say whether they obeyed it. Luke records their obedience, but he omits the command. Which of these guys copied from the other one? Trick question. The answer is no, right? This is not the way copying goes. Which of these guys embellished the story of the other? Neither one, because each one of them is missing something the other one is supplying. You see how that works? So we'll just take the original one. Mark is supplying us here with something that explains a detail in Luke. Are you getting the hang of this now? Do you see how this goes? Good. Let's have a little fun. We're going to play a game. And the game has a simple rule. The rule is this. You're not allowed to play if you've already heard me do this talk. But otherwise, you're invited to play. And before we do, just audience check, how many of you, deep breath, honesty time, how many of you have read through the Gospels at least one time? Whew, I love you people. Okay, so here's the challenge. What are we told about the New Testament? I teach at a secular university, so I have colleagues in the comparative religion department just downstairs from me. Sitting at a banquet with one of them, and he leans over talking to somebody. He says, I think they're just legends, he says, about the Gospels. Well, there's the news from that vector. So here's our challenge. We all know kind of how the Gospels sound. We've read through them. We have a sense of what they're about, the kind of stuff they tell about Jesus. So I think we are the perfect group to forge a gospel story. We are going to make up, just invent a story about Jesus. We're going to make it a miracle story, and these suckers are going to buy it. And we have the information. At the beginning, we're going to set it up by having Jesus ask one of his disciples a question. All right? The story that we're going to tell is going to have to do with money and food. So here's the question. We're going to set this up with Jesus turning to one of his disciples. Which disciple? Which disciple do we pick? Remember, we want this to sound authentic. We want people to fall for it. Jesus turns to one of his disciples. Which one shall we make it be? Peter. Why? Because Peter's everywhere in the Gospels and nobody will know the difference. I think we could probably get away with that. Who else? Judas. Why Judas? He's the guy with the money bag. Perfect. Wow. We are clever. We are going to pull this one over on them. Any other options? Matthew? Why Matthew? Tax collector has to do with money? That would be kind of subtle. I like it. I think we could make this happen. Before you know it, we'll all have tenure at Harvard. So John tells us, lifting up his eyes and seeing a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat? Now, be it said with all due reverence, but for one of the disciples of Jesus Christ on earth, Philip is as close to a non-entity in the Gospels as it is possible to be. After he calls the disciples, Jesus speaks to Philip twice. This is one of them. If you were making it up, why would you pick Philip? Why would you do that? He's not everywhere in the gospel, so we don't have the Peter excuse. He's not the guy with the money bag. We don't have that excuse. Perhaps he lived nearby, but did he live nearby? How would we know that? So, let's connect some dots. Luke chapter 9, same story, feeding the 5,000. Just gives us a little bit of extra info at the start. And he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. When the crowds learned it, they followed him. You will alertly notice that this passage says nothing whatsoever about Philip. But then, let's connect it with a passage in John 6 chapters on from where we're reading. Go to John 12. Some Greeks come. They want to talk to Jesus. And they come first to Philip, and it just says in passing, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee. Do you see how the pieces of that puzzle fit together? Luke doesn't mention Philip in this context at all. John doesn't mention that Bethsaida was the setting of the miracle. It's only by putting them together we can understand why Jesus turns to Philip and says, in effect, Philip, you're from around here. How much is this going to cost at the local supermarket? You really think we can handle this? Philip's like, no, not going to happen. How indirect is that? How subtle is the ring of truth? If we were making it up, Not where we would have gone. If we were writing the whole Gospel of John and we wanted to make sure to make this plausible, we would have included in John the fact that the miracle happens in Bethsaida. But John doesn't. He's just telling you the story. And you have to connect the dots in several places to make it come together. That's not what fictions and forgeries look like. We know what fictions and forgeries look like. We have plenty of gospel fictions from the second century. They're called Gnostic Gospels, stories about Jesus as a young boy. Very exciting stuff. You know what Jesus was like as a young boy, according to the stuff out of the second century? He's like an evil Harry Potter. The boys are playing a little bit roughly, and one boy knocks Jesus down. So Jesus strikes him dead. And the dead boy's mother goes to Mary and says, "Your boy killed my boy. Make him take it back." And Mary comes to Jesus and says, "Now, Jesus, that wasn't very nice. You should probably raise him from the dead." So Jesus raises the kid from the dead. Stuff like that. Tons of that. No undesigned coincidences. No links interlocking like this. This is not what fictions and forgeries look like. This is what truth looks like. So if you're doing the network, then here it keeps growing. Now we've got something in Luke helping us to explain something in John. See how that works? Do you notice anything about these arrows? They're kind of going all over the place, aren't they? It's not like Mark is the one doing all the explaining of everybody else and none of the others explain anything. Think about that for a minute. Hold that thought. Let's do another example. Let's start with Mark this time. Mark chapter 6, also the feeding of the 5,000. By the way, it's really interesting. This miracle story has more interlockings like this than any other incident in the Gospels. And I think one of the reasons is that it's told by all four Gospel writers. So Mark says, "And he said to them, 'Come away by yourselves to a desolate place and rest a while, for many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat.'" Hold that thought. Many were coming and going. Such a crowd that they were even trying just to find a place to sit down and eat. That's verse 31. Verse 39, they've tried to get away from the crowd, but the crowd has followed them, and when Jesus sees it, he commands them all to sit down on the green grass. Now, two things about this. First of all, you might think at first, if you're just reading along quickly, that the crowd was there because Jesus was there. But that won't fly. Because Jesus suggests that they come aside to try to get away from the crowd. It's a suggestion that doesn't even make sense if they're all to see him. That would be like telling Gary Habermas, "Hey, Gary, how about if you go out into the hallway away from this precipice?" No, they're all going to follow Gary. Right? Of course they are. They're there to see him. Sorry, I'm picking on Gary because he's the grandfather everybody wishes they had. He really is. What a great guy. If they were there to see Jesus, come aside into a deserted place would make absolutely no sense, even as an idea. It's not going to work. The second thing I want you to focus on is that green grass. How many of you have had the privilege of visiting the Holy Land? When did you go? March? Okay, you might have been there in the spring season there. If you were not there in March, then I have a question about that green grass. Yeah, no. Not mostly green. Most of the time, the grass is withered and parched. It's not green. Except, of course, it has to grow sometime, doesn't it? When was the grass green? Springtime. What else happens in springtime? Well, if you're a Jew, what happens in springtime is what John tells you in his setup for the story of the same miracle, the same feeding of the 5,000. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Now, get this. Passover is in the middle of the month-long growing season when the grass would be green. Also, there were many coming and going. How many Jews from the Roman Empire came to celebrate Passover every year, came for the week-long festival? Josephus, the Jewish historian, says 3 million people a year came to Jerusalem. For an ancient city to have 3 million people converging upon it makes this conference look kind of small. Now, let's suppose Josephus was exaggerating, that he was off by a factor of 10, that it was only 300,000 people coming from around the Roman Empire. You know what? That's still a lot of people. That's a plenty good explanation for why there were many coming and going. And a good explanation for why the grass was green. So this account interlocks John's little comment that lets us place the time of this, interlocks in two ways with details of Mark's account that are otherwise just floating out there. So if you're doing the arrows, do this. Now we've got one that's going up from John to Mark. This is the point where we get to one of the payoffs of doing this kind of a diagram. Every one of the Gospels is explaining some things in other Gospels. What does that say to you? Every one of these authors has at least some independent sources of information. Otherwise, they wouldn't interlock in a way that has each of them explaining things in the others. Each of them has an arrow going away from it. Each of them has an arrow going toward it. All of these Gospels interlock. There's a problem that we puzzle over in seminary classes called the synoptic problem. How many of you are familiar with that? So the synoptic problem is this. The first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are called the synoptic Gospels. They basically cover the same events. Parts of them fall into the same order. What's the relationship among the synoptic Gospels? Did Mark write first, and then did Matthew use the framework of Mark's gospel and put some more information in, but also leave some things out, and then Luke come along and sort of use Mark? Or did Matthew write first and then Mark write a summary and then Luke come along and do his? What's the relationship? Which one has priority? And the serious, sober, shocking truth about the synoptic problem is that from the standpoint of the reliability of the gospels, it doesn't matter. It does not matter whether you hold to Markan priority or Matthean priority or Lindsayan Bivens Lucan priority school. It just doesn't matter, because what really matters is, did they all have independent sources of information? Are they all close up to the facts and habitually truthful? If they are, then it doesn't matter if Matthew was writing along and said, yeah, no, Mark already wrote that story up. Let me just see how he did it and made some use of it. Because Matthew also has little things like those three words, to his servants, little independent bits, even in things which, in the technical terminology of seminary, we call the same pericope. Well, that pericope means little story, self-contained story. That pericope in Matthew is also in Mark. Yeah, it is, but the words to his servants aren't. It just doesn't matter which one of these guys wrote first, or wrote first in Greek. Did Matthew write first in Greek? Did he write first in Aramaic, and then later a version of the gospel got put over into? Doesn't matter. You can take any position on the synoptic problem, and it won't affect the basic reliability. Now, that is not what you hear if you go on to the internet, where, of course, you have to believe it because it's on the internet, right? How many of you know what XKCD comics are? My favorite XKCD of all time. This guy hunched over a computer, and a voice from another room says, "You should come to bed, it's late." "I can't. Someone on the internet is wrong." And then if you hover over that last frame, it continues. "What do you want me to do, stop?" "Then they'll go on being wrong." On the internet, if you hang out on some of the atheist chat boards, what you will hear is, "There's really only one gospel, it's Mark, and everybody else just copied Mark and then added a bunch of legends." And that won't fly. That won't fit the facts that we are looking at right here. Because adding a bunch of legends to Mark doesn't make John explain Mark, and it doesn't make Luke explain John and Matthew, and it doesn't make Matthew explain John. It doesn't work that way. Adding a bunch of legends doesn't create this kind of a network. Now, there are many, many more of these. I'll do a couple more here, and then we'll go to some Q&A. But I just wanted to mention that my wife wrote a book on this stuff, not only among the Gospels, but also between the Gospels, or sorry, the book of Acts and the letters of Paul. There are interlockings, undesigned coincidences, crisscrossing the narratives in all directions. She's got a chapter called The Synoptic Gospels Explain John. Just examples where you find things in the Synoptics that explain things in John. She has another chapter called John Explains the Synoptic Gospels. Just examples where John's the one doing the explaining. She has another chapter called The Synoptic Gospels Explain Each Other. And so it goes. There are dozens of these, and I am persuaded we haven't even yet found them all. This is just one kind of evidence. If you want to pick up a copy of the book, the reason that she wrote it is that she and I had a deal. If she got to it first, she would write it, and if I got to it first, I would write it, and she beat me. Which is great, because now I don't have to do it. The title is Hidden in Plain View. Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. And where's Mia? Mia, wave at everybody. Mia's standing in the back. Mia's my partner in crime. Over in the glass-walled room out there in the main hallway near the front, we've got a table, and we actually have some copies of this, which are for sale if you want to pick it up. But lest you should say, I am only here to sell books, if you just want some examples of this argument and you want them for free, that's great. We have these for you for free as well, because at the Library of Historical Apologetics, we put together these resources, these forgotten arguments. My friend Bob Stewart likes to say, Tim has found stuff so old, it's new. And it is. I mean, when I tell William Lane Craig about these things, he's never heard of them before. This is new. And it's old. And that's kind of beautiful. So, let's do some more examples, just because it's a cumulative case, and maybe you're sitting there unpersuaded so far, so let's do some more. Example number 5, Luke 23 tells the story of how the Jews, having decided that Jesus is worthy of death, drag him before Pontius Pilate. So, he's being hauled after his trial by night before Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation." Reality check. Pilate doesn't care. Why not? Because he's not a Jew. He's not there to regulate Jewish internal affairs. If he's misleading your nation, that's your problem. "And forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar." Did Jesus forbid them to give tribute to Caesar? No, he actually didn't. So that one probably didn't stick very well. "And saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And now we have a problem. Because nobody becomes king in the Roman Empire except by Caesar's permission. You want to be a client king of the Romans? You go to Rome, cap in hand, and you ask very nicely if Caesar would let you be a king, and you probably bring him a lot of gold also just to sweeten the deal. And maybe he'll let you. Nobody sets up as a king by himself. So Pilate, being a Roman governor, does the sensible thing. He asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says to him, "You have said so." In Greek, it's even more terse, it's just two words, "souleges." It probably means, "You said it yourself." It might mean, "Well, so you say." Under no circumstances does it mean, "Who, me, what?" No, there's been a terrible misunderstanding. That is not what it means. So Pilate just makes this grave accusation, right? And Jesus says, "Yep," or "You said it." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." What? Can we do the instant replay on that one? The Jews make a grave accusation. Pilate questions Jesus on this very point. Jesus admits the charge, or at the very least refuses to deny it. And Pilate promptly declares him to be innocent. What the heck is going on? Hello? Does that make sense? Did you hit a speed bump when you were reading through the Gospel of Luke and think to yourself, what, that doesn't compute? Isn't it a great thing that we have four Gospels? We have another account of this exchange between Jesus and Pilate, but it has a lot more detail. It's found over in John chapter 18, verses 33 through 38. And in part, that goes this way. Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world." oh, Pilate thinks, he's one of those philosopher kings. Not a real king with real authority and soldiers and swords and spears who's going to raise a rebellion against Rome. He's some kind of, yeah, whatever. Okay, fine. Pilate went back outside of the Jews and said, I find no guilt in him. Now this makes sense, doesn't it? Notice this is a double undesigned coincidence because in John's account, Pilate's question comes out of nowhere. Please go back to John 18. Please go back to your own Bible. If I have not inspired you to go back and read your own Bibles differently, I have failed today. I want you to go back and start cross-comparing these things. Nowhere in John 18 does it list, he's made himself to be a king as a challenge. Pilate's clearly grumpy. He's been gotten up early, like I was today, and he says, all right, what's he done? And all they get out of them that is recorded in John's narrative is, if he weren't a malefactor, we wouldn't have brought him to you. At which point Pilate's like, great, so you deal with it. No, we can't put somebody to death. All right. And then he brings him in. And then he asks him, out of the blue, are you a king? What, you know, you want to say to Pilate, do you ask every criminal who's brought to you if he's a king? Is that just like this thing with you that you do? Is it on your little checklist? That's a crazy question to ask somebody at random. But you see, Luke gives us the accusation, but not the full answer. John gives us the full answer, but not the accusation. Which of these guys copied from the other one? No is also the right answer here. Not the way you explain this phenomenon of the interlockings that are going on among the Gospels. Can you see this? Do you feel the force of this kind of evidence? I hope some of you have some kind of teaching ministry. It could be at a coffee shop with one other person across the table. That's great. That's fine. Some of my best teaching ever has been done one-on-one. Maybe you teach a class in a church. Maybe you'll have a chance to speak at a church. Consider using some of this stuff. I gave a talk on this down in Louisiana. Had a chance to speak in a church when I was speaking at a conference in New Orleans. And the first guy up to shake my hand after the message was a prosecuting attorney. Really sharp guy. You can just look in his eyes and you're like, this guy has IQ points to burn. And he says to me, I'm an attorney. I want more of that. I said, that's great. So I chatted with him for a few minutes and I gave him a book because that's what I do. I'm a professor. I give people books. About the fifth guy in line was a construction worker who told me that he takes cement from demolished construction sites and reconstitutes it and then resells it. He's about 6'6". His hands look like a construction worker's hands, and he looms over me and he says, I want more of that. I'm looking at him and I'm trying to, you know, calibrate here. I'm like, okay, what level were you looking for? Whatever level you was talking at this morning, that's the level I want. So I gave him a book. Everybody can get this. It's not subtle. It's not rocket science. It's not like trying to use loop quantum gravity to talk about the Kalam cosmological argument. Everybody gets this, and they walk out with the evidence in their hands. It's the same Bible you walked in with. You just have a different way of looking at it, a different way of reading it now. And that's what I'd like to just encourage you, challenge you, urge you to do. Wrap your head around some of these examples and start telling people. Get the word out. This is an argument that got forgotten from the end of the 19th century to about the middle of the 20th century. Some of you may have heard of the great biblical scholar F.F. Bruce. Fantastic training. Bruce had never heard of this argument until the middle of his career, and then he discovers it. He writes this excited paper about, like, this is this great argument. We should all be using this argument. He's clearly never heard of it before. But now you don't have that excuse, do you? So if our network continues to grow now, we've got more connections going back and forth between Luke and John.
Which can all be explained if only you assume that Mark was the first gospel written.
No, I don't think that explains the connection between Luke and John, actually. But you will find people out there. This is the standard line in the, you know, secular outpost community. That's just Mark in priority. It explains everything. Don't think so. Don't think it works that way. Let's do one more here. John 21 tells us about a meeting between Jesus and his disciples after the resurrection. So the very setting of this presupposes the stupendous miracle of the resurrection of Jesus, okay? Jesus calls to them from the shore. John says, it's the Lord. Peter jumps out of the boat, because that's Peter, right? He's always out there at the front running in. And Jesus is cooking some fish for them. And after breakfast, Jesus says to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? What does that mean? Do you love me more than these? It means, do you love me more than these other disciples love me? Now, isn't that a kind of a cruel question to ask? I mean, if Jesus said to me, do you love me? I'd say, Lord, you know both that I love you and you, what a screw up I am, but yes, I love you. But if he said, do you love me more than Greg loves me? I'm like, that's off my pay scale. I don't know. I'm not going to go there. I wouldn't feel competent to say that. So to have the question posed, wow, that seems kind of harsh. Why is Jesus picking on Peter? Why does he say to Peter, do you love me more than the other disciples do? Well, you know, not too many days earlier, the disciples were in the upper room at the Last Supper bickering about which one of them was the most faithful. And Peter, God bless him, opens his big mouth and says, even though they all fall away, I will not. An inauspicious beginning for the first pope. Peter, remove the sandal from your trachea here. Get it back out, man. Come on. What is this? Really? Really you said that? What do you think Jesus is reminding him? Do you love me more than they do? Why is Jesus saying that? What happened at the end of Mark 14? They're out. They go to the Garden of Gethsemane. Suddenly there's torchlight approaching them and a band of soldiers. And what are we told? They all abandoned him and fled. And then we get the pathetic and sorry story of Peter's even going and denying his Lord. How many times did Peter deny his Lord? Three times. Check out John 21. How many times does Jesus say to him, Peter, do you love me? Think he's reminding him of something? So, from the standpoint of the network, this is now a case where we've got a connection from Mark to John. And they just keep going. There's just more and more and more of these. I told you, it's a dangerous thing to tell a professor to start talking, right? I mean, it really is. Let's just sum this up. The separate narratives that we have in the four Gospels are independently grounded in the same actual facts. We have four Gospels. They're written by four different authors, but they interlock with one another. They explain one another in ways that point to truth. If you want more of this kind of argument, you can get John James Blunt's book, The Veracity of the Gospels and Acts, which is then republished as Undesigned Coincidences throughout the 19th century. If you want to know where to get that, I can tell you. If you want a more recent, updated version of this, you can catch a copy of Lydia's book, Hidden in Plain View, which we have some for sale a little cheaper than you can get them on Amazon. So come on over and see us. And if you want to know where to download Blunt or a bunch of other resources, any VeggieTales fans out there?
Have we got a show for you?
Yes, we have boatloads of this stuff at historicalapologetics.org. The page where you go, you download stuff, and we don't come chasing after you, asking you for your money, because this is free. Augustine says that of all the things in the world, truth is the most valuable and the most beautiful, because unlike gold, you can give truth away and you still have it. That's what I want to do to you. I hope I have put tools in your hands here, and you can go away with these and you can give them to other people and you'll still have them. That's a great thing. We have two things. We're going to do some Q&A, but meanwhile, Mia is waving at me, reminding me that we've got little cards. We collect info on people who come to our talks, if you would like to sign up for a newsletter that never, ever, ever shares your email address with anybody and we only send out 4 times a year, sign up for us. Tell us. Tell us you'd like more. Put your email address down, and we will know to make contact with you and tell us if you learned something. I would be glad to think that some of you felt you had learned something. We have about 8 minutes left, and there is a handheld mic here. So if you want to ask me any question, we have somebody right up here in the front who knows he's got a question. So we're going to bring it up and take a few questions here. And he didn't fall asleep. I checked. So I succeeded somewhat.
Just a quick question. How would you phrase like a response, and is it possible to use this method to disprove things like the Quran because of the distance in time between the stories about Christ? Because there are later, I know the Gnostics are right around the same time, so that would fit well into disproving it. But how about something far away?
Right, so this is a piece of positive evidence. The first thing I want to say is that as a piece of positive evidence, this is designed to make a case. From the fact that you don't have undesigned coincidences, you can make, I think, only a rather weak argument against something. Okay. It might just be too brief. There might have not have been enough other people writing their narratives for you to cross-check. And that's okay. That happens sometime in history. So the mere absence of undesigned coincidences won't disprove something. As far as the stories about Muhammad, you've got to make a sharp distinction between what's in the Quran and what's in the Hadith, which are written a century on and later, and are stories collected about him. And the Hadith have a lot of things about Muhammad, but not interlocking like this and not as close up to the time period either. Some of the events that the Quran narrates, I would accept. Even some of the things that are in the Hadith, I would accept. I think that Muhammad was a warlord. I think he conquered various towns. I think he probably had certain kinds of arguments with some of his followers. And so I wouldn't want to say there's nothing historical about Muhammad. There's a fair bit.
No, I'm referring to the stories about Jesus in the Quran.
The stories about Jesus
Muhammad.
In the Quran, I think our strongest ground for doubting those is that the unique stories about Jesus in the Quran don't even appear until you're off into the 7th century, and so they're all so much later. And also, we can trace some roots to them. They're like desert mystic traditions that were coming up in the 3rd and 4th century already. I actually was on a dissertation committee for somebody who wrote a book on this. So if you will give me your email address and say you want more information about that, I will write back, and I will tell you where you can get his
now. Send it to Facebook, because we talk all the time.
Yeah, his published dissertation would be a good source on that. Okay. Great, thank you for that.
And do you affirm the virgin birth?
Do I affirm the virgin birth? This is a Facebook thing. Yes, and you can tell Nick Peters and Eric Chabot that I affirm the virgin birth. There we go. Somebody back there has a question? And then up here next. Okay.
Just a quick one about the word undesigned. I can see that the logic shows that there wasn't human collusion,
mm-hmm.
but are you open to the fact that there's divine providence in this sort of weaving together? In that sense, it could very much be designed,
right.
divinely designed, but human.
Right, so the word was initially chosen to indicate that the authors were not attempting to create the effect. I certainly don't think anything that we have in the Gospels caught God by surprise. All right, so that... I'm absolutely fine with that. But what I want to stress really is the continuity between the kind of reasoning we would use in historical accounts and the kind of reasoning that we use here. Secular history, the lead up to the disastrous Battle of Hastings, Harold's brother Tostig takes a trip. One source says that he landed at a certain point, doesn't say where he came from. Another source says he set sail from the Isle of Man, but doesn't say where he was going. Actually, it's a pretty natural route. We take those two things in these secular historical documents, we fit them together, and we say, oh yeah, okay, that sheds a favorable light on both of these accounts. So it's a kind of thing we would do in documents that we wouldn't even dream of calling inspired. So certainly God was aware of it all, but I think it's kind of beautiful that he used normal, truthful human witnesses who were close up to the facts, and they reported what they saw, and we just happened to have four of them. Isn't that a great thing? Any other questions? I got one up here, and one there. I think I can take two.
I have not read the book that your wife wrote that you wish you had written. but I wondered whether you had any inkling about the story of the young man in the garden who's naked and who has the linen cloth pulled from him, and whether that's interlocked with the idea that Jesus is praying off by himself and all the disciples are sleeping. How do we have a record of what he said in that prayer? And yet there was another guy in the garden, and it was the young man with the linen cloth. Could he have been the one that heard?
It's possible, and some have hypothesized that since the story is found in Mark, that it was John Mark himself. I don't know. But remember, according to Christianity, Jesus didn't stay dead. And he hung out with his followers for 40 days afterward, before the ascension, and showed himself alive by many infallible proofs. There's plenty of time for him to have talked about that at that point. It's an interesting conjecture. Could it have been Mark himself, who was maybe not supposed to be there, but was skulking around following? It is possible. I just don't
know. Another conjecture is the linen cloth, the same linen cloth that Joseph of Arimathea took and buried Jesus in which case the linen would represent the shame in the garden of nakedness and running away. And so Jesus is buried in our shame.
That's a beautiful thought, but I don't have the historical data to be able to nail that down. And what I like to do when I give talks and when I'm reasoning with people, especially skeptics, is I like to use arguments that are bulletproof. And so I want to stick with the ones I'm sure I can pick out. Liberty, red shirt right here. You had your hand in the air. Last question. Let's go to you.
I was wondering if the Q document or the Q hypothesis played any role in this.
So does the hypothesis that there is a sayings source called Q, maybe for the German Quelle source, does that play any role in this? And the beautiful answer is no, none whatsoever. There could be a Q document. There could be no Q document. Q could end up being just part of Matthew, which it kind of looks like. And it doesn't matter. Because any way you slice it, all of these guys have things that are used to explain otherwise unexplained things in the other Gospels. So, again, part of the beauty of this argument is that it is free from any particular position that you might take on that. And that's a really valuable thing. Thank you all for your attention. Time is up.